Most of them.
Yeah, so I just, some days I don't know which one.
The joint meeting of the Senate Tax Committee and the Senate Finance Committee will please come to order. Today is Thursday, February 3rd, 2011. And the first thing we have on our agenda is a report, the State Budget Trends Study Commission report presentation, and we have Kevin Gouineau as our presenter this morning.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. My name is Kevin Gouineau, and I was the co-chair of the Budget Trends Commission that was established in 2007. And with me today is...
My name is Britta Rayton, and I'm with MMB, and I was staff to the commission.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'd like to go through the presentation. The Budget Trends Study Commission was established in 2007 by act of the legislature. It called for 15 members, five appointed by the Senate, five appointed by the House, and five appointed by the governor. The commission itself was, I would say, tripartisan. It was made up of, and let me get the, well, let me just say the commission charge is before you to look at state demographic trends and to look at the volatility of the state budget and come back with some recommendations with regard to the future aspects and what we can put into place to first of all, manage the volatility of the state budget, look at the trends, demographic trends that are out there, and how we can prepare for the future to match revenues with expenditures. The members of the commission, as I mentioned, there are 15 total members, a couple of former legislators, a couple of economists. I know this sounds like the beginning of a joke. Actually, a couple lobbyists who are involved in the business community. And we had four different commissioners of finance that were involved in, I think, at least three to four administrations. Jay Kodrowski, the co-chair, was the commissioner of finance with Rudy Perpich, also Governor Perpich. And we had John Gunyu with the Carlson administration, Peggy Ingeson with the Plante administration, and Pam Wheelock with the Ventura administration. So we had quite a mixture of folks. The commission's recommendations and findings were unanimous from this group. We had one minority report on one element, and I'll mention that as we move forward. But we made 14 primary findings, and then we had recommendations based on those findings. And I'll quickly walk through those findings, and if you have any questions, Britta is here to help us help me answer those questions. As I mentioned before, the commission itself started meeting in the fall of 2007. We issued our report in January of 2009. So some of the information is been dated by a couple years, and I'll point out those areas that I'm aware of that may have changed since that time. But number one finding that we had was that Minnesota is experiencing a major long-term demographic shift. The major shift is the fact that we're getting older and that the population is getting older. And if you can see in this slide, from 2005 to 2015, the fastest growth in Minnesota will be of those aged 55 to 69. Second issue is that Minnesota has become more diverse in recent years, and this will continue to increase as economic growth depends on drawing new workers to the state. We are still, as a state, we're becoming more diverse, but relative to the rest of the country, we're still not that diverse. But we are becoming more diverse, and that puts different strains on our system as well. Finding number three is public spending priorities will need to shift as Minnesota's economically dependent population grows larger and relies more heavily on fewer workers. This chart shows the dependency ratio, the folks that are dependent on those that are wage earners and taxpayers. And you can see the shift if you look at 1990, the aged dependency, that would be the elderly, has been a relatively stable number from 1960 all the way through 2010, with the largest dependency being among the youth. You can start seeing the shift where the dependency is shifting away from towards the elderly and away from the youth. So when you're looking at pressures on families and the society, before it used to be the pressure of the family, the working family, raising their children and that dependency and taking care of those dependents, and now it's shifting that more and more of those families will be having to deal with dependents that are also older in older populations.
Madam Chair.
Senator Senchum.
Madam Chair, thank you. And Representative Gouineau, not asking you to get too far into it, but you recall a little bit about what, when you use the word dependent population, any idea what that word dependent really means?
Madam Chair and Senator, it's really just based on age. So this is a measure used by the demographer's office, and it looks at those over the age of 64 in those 0 to 14.
Madam.
It's dependent based on, usually they are the age cohorts that are more more public spending is geared towards those age cohorts.
But, Madam Chair, and to the witness, you're not necessarily talking about any specific enrollment in any programs or anything like that. Okay, thank you.
No.
And, Madam Chair, Senator Senja, this also looking forward is just projections. Again, we're everything's our best guess as we move forward. So, also under that same category of the dependent population, this is just a chart that shows the shift of folks in different age brackets. So you can see the high in 2020, how the population over 65 increases dramatically as it compares to some of the other populations.
Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, Representative Goodenough, there, I don't know if this has changed, but to follow up on the dependency notion, you were referring more to kind of dependent on families, not necessarily government in your first statement. There's a lot of discussion that the elderly population is they are the holder of a lot of wealth. So when you refer to the dependency, is the dependency those that do not and become dependent on government, or is it that they have greater needs, which they may or may not be able to pay for themselves? How are you?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, what I would think is that it's a combination, that it's people that will have greater needs. I think these statistics are based not off the ability to pay for them. Based on my background information, this was not part of our I think we did have a presentation on it, but it being 2 or 3 years ago, I don't recall the exact numbers, but there's some pretty dramatic statistics on the savings that baby boomers have done for their future and for their retirement, and they're not very good.
Okay.
So even I would even disagree with that. That's the cohort of wealth. They're producing wealth now because they're generating income and they're paying taxes on that. But the savings factor, I think, is a challenge.
So, Madam Chair,
Senator Olson,
that is a change in that. I think the demographic cohort that did amass wealth were probably coming out of the Depression, were savers, had a different style or way of that is not reflected in the current cohort that is moving into that age group.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I would say I would agree with that.
Okay, thank you.
Britta, could you state your last name again?
Sure. It's Rayton.
Rayton? Ms. Rayton.
Madam Chair, and I think the word dependency, I think, has some connotation to it that maybe isn't intended. It's really just a measure used by the demographer's office to look at the age cohorts that are usually within the working population and those that are non-working. So it's usually youth that are before their age of working and then those that are retired.
Okay. And I think the next slide, Madam Chair, members, will help show that what we talk about with the whole issue of the needs are greater. This shows that individuals 45 to 54 spend nearly half the amount of health care as those ages 55 to 64. So we have more of our population shifting into the 55 to 64 bracket. Our costs and the cost of the system overall, both publicly funded and privately funded, will be increasing. This is one of the findings that we made. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it. It just because we don't think it's true anymore. But at the time the report was made is that it showed that Minnesota's economy had underperformed recently relative to the nation. We actually have a relatively good unemployment rate as compared to the nation right now, so this finding isn't completely accurate anymore. So we'll just move on. Item number 5, demographic and economic factors will lead to lower growth in state's tax revenues over the next 25 years. That's related to the fact that I mentioned before with regard to Senator Olson's question, that as the population continues to age, fewer and fewer people will be in the income-making bracket, so to speak, and will, you know, earn less income. Will earn less income, and at the same time, then will be generating less tax revenues for us. This is the average growth rates in the revenues as we're going forward, and you can see from 2001 to 2033 that the expected growth in revenues is declining. As opposed, in 2001, total was 6.8% growth factor, and in 2033 it's projected to be at 3.9%. Finding number six, Minnesota has a long-term structural budget problem with long-term expenditure growth likely to outpace revenue growth. This is the most frightening finding that we made. And I think you've seen a similar slide presentation. What this is looking at projected growth into the future, the next 20 years, and what the average growth factor is in the various areas. This shows the average revenue growth expected to be at 3.9%. The growth on healthcare spending is at 8.5%, education spending at 4.8%, with a total expected or projected spending at 5.4% growth factor. The bottom line on this, and why I think this is challenging to us, is that even if you balance the budget by raising taxes, decreasing spending, doing whatever, if the other factor, the other inflationary factors on the revenue side and the expenditure sides remain constant, we'll be out of balance next year on average, because we have the growth factor on the expenditures are expected to outpace the growth factor on revenues. Finding number seven, healthcare growth will become the most important factor in controlling rising state expenditures. This is just pulling out this from the slide before that healthcare is at 8.5% increase. It far outpaces any of the other growth factors within the state government budget areas. Item number eight, emphasizes the challenge in dealing with the growth factor. State revenue volatility will make long-term budget instability more difficult to manage. So if you look at the growth factor on income tax, are these statistics still relatively okay? Just checking. If you look at the growth factors, those revenue sources that provide the greatest potential for growth are also the most volatile. So if you want to try to meet the target of matching revenue growth with expenditure growth, what you have to do is go to revenue streams that are much more volatile, which then adds to the volatility within our budgetary system. And so that's a challenge that the policymakers, you all, have to face moving forward.
Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you. Could you go back to that slide and just a couple follow-up questions, if I may? I see that other revenue is pretty significant, 11% of the growth and 13% of the total. Can you give us what are the big portions of that?
I'm checking with our economist here. Madam Chair and Senator, it looks like property tax is a portion of it. Deed and mortgage taxes.
And Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, if you look at the last column, the 13.3%, it shows the proportion of those revenues as it makes up the pie.
So
it's relatively small.
Mr. Goodnow, so you're not counting locally collected property taxes in this. This is general fund. Right?
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, I believe it's the state collected taxes.
Yep.
Senator Olson.
Well, Madam Chair, you're referring to the state property tax. Mm-hmm. Thank
Madam,
you.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson.
Mr. Goodnow. Senator Ortman.
Thank you. Commissioner Goodnow, can you explain that middle column, the tax base volatility? How is that measured? Because that's one of the things we're trying to do is eliminate volatility in our revenue sources so that we have a more stable source of revenue. I'm just wondering, how do we measure that?
Madam Chair, Chair Ortman, I think we need an economist to answer that question.
Okay.
Madam Chair, my name is Matt Shepard. For the record, I work for Tom Stinson at MMB, and Tom and I were the ones that put together this study back a couple years ago. And for the most part, this these numbers do hold still true, except that the world as we know it today is a little bit different, quite a bit different than it was when we thought about it 2 years ago. So some of this, in terms of the risk, or the middle column, which I would call it your risk factor, has probably even grown more if we were to run this study again. The volatility around the tax base has increased. Getting at your question, this is really the study looked at a trend growth rate of each of the tax base, these four pieces. And then the volatility is kind of the way that these jump around in terms of a year-to-year growth rate, jump around that growth rate. And so, for example, on average, the individual income tax is about 3.1% plus or minus off of that trend growth rate in any given year on average. But that can, that's a 66, well, I'm not going to get into that type of, but okay, I think that I'll suffice and stop there.
Senator Ortman.
So does that mean, if I'm reading it correctly, if I've been believing that the sales tax is the most reliable source of revenues for the state of Minnesota. Is this chart supporting that by showing that the deviation each year over year is only 2.1%?
Mr. Scheffner?
That's correct.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair, I think the next slide actually will help with that, too. If you look at the next finding, it's Minnesota's general fund tax base has grown more volatile in the past decade. We show the yellow solid bars are an annual or a rolling 5-year average, I believe, or something. Remember that? Oh wow, I got that right. And that the red line or whatever color that is shows the actual budget variation. So the gold line kind of shows an average 5-year rolling average, which kind of moderates the spikes and the volatility. It does show that we still have that it's very volatile out there. Next finding, Minnesota's general fund tax base has grown more volatile in the past decade. That just supports what we just mentioned. This shows the different revenue streams, corporate income taxes in the green. The maroon color is other revenues. Individual income taxes in the red, and then the blue is the sales tax, which supports the point that it's the most stable. All right, this one, replacing highly volatile tax-based components with less volatile sources could reduce the volatility of the overall general fund tax system. However, such changes would also affect revenue growth rates and the distribution of the tax burden among the taxpayers. So this is just a finding stating that when we looked at that chart before, you can decrease volatility in the system. And one of the reasons for the commission was really to look at the spikes where we had these huge surpluses for a period of time of billions of dollars, and we had huge deficits of billions of dollars. How do we reduce that volatility? This is saying you can take out the more volatile revenue streams, but then it will impact the growth in the system, and it also will redistribute how those funds are raised. So if you expand the sales tax or increase the sales tax, you will be going to a more regressive tax system. We're not making our findings based on regressivity or progressivity. We're just saying that is a factor that people have to consider when they're making decisions. You have volatility, growth, and regressivity or progressivity within your system. So those are the factors that are all kind of interactive. And if you try to address one issue, you're going to have corresponding impacts on the other issues.
Madam Senator Olson.
Madam Chair and Representative Goodenough, what do you include in terms of the sales tax? I think people think of just like the clothing and food, but what about addition to services where there's, to some extent, greater freedom of choice in it? How does that factor into the regressivity, progressivity?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, this finding is just based on the averages of the current system. Within the current system. So we didn't look at expanding sales tax to clothing or food or other services.
Thank you.
I might add, though, as part of that.
Mr. Rayton.
As part of that.
Mr. Scheffner.
We did look at other pieces that are not taxed within the sales tax base. So for example, we did look at the volatility of clothing, and we did look at the volatility of food and
separate
services. And that's not in this report, but it is in our presentation.
Mr. Schiffner, when you looked at those, how volatile were they? Were they very stable, or did they have a lot of variation in them as well?
They being food and clothing.
Food and clothing. And services in particular.
Yes, they're actually very close, probably even less, a little less than the overall sales tax base volatility is shown here, each of those components individually. So if they were introduced, it's likely that they would lower the overall volatility of the sales tax base, but then there's also this piece that we looked at and how they interact together. So, for example, corporate taxes typically have a lag in terms of when we finally receive the overall. Or individual income tax is another example of that. There's a lag when the economic activity actually occurs and when the state actually receives the revenue. And so over time, there's an interaction between these, and they tend to smooth each other out based on the lags and things of the receipts. So I'm getting a little too loud again. To answer your question, yes, the clothing and the sales and the services that we looked at had a lower volatility rate than the overall sales tax base.
Madam Chair, one item or piece of information I was struck with in serving on the commission was that you can actually take out a very volatile revenue stream out of the system, and you may actually increase the volatility of the overall system. So I think that goes to Mr. Shepherd's points that there's interactions between these revenue streams, and if you just take one out without considering the other ramifications and how it interacts with the others, that you could actually be going the opposite direction than what your intention was. I always look at him to make sure I'm still saying the right thing. So, all right. Members, finding number 11 is adjusting the mix of the current tax base while remaining revenue growth rate neutral cannot significantly reduce revenue volatility without a dramatic reweighting of the tax revenue sources and a radical change in the tax rates to the system. Similar to what we were mentioning before, but basically tweaking this tax system to reduce volatility won't do it. You need to do something more dramatic than that. And that is basically what this finding is saying, that there's no easy, simple tweaking that can be done to reduce volatility within the system. Number five, shifting consumption patterns have reduced Minnesota's sales tax base. We touched on that earlier. We're moving more to a service economy. Folks are spending less money on those products that we charge a sales tax for, and also with the people's purchasing habits, purchasing over the internet. Although they're supposed to be paying sales tax on those purchases, they don't. So we have been seeing a declining, on average, an erosion of that tax base.
Mr. Goodnow, when we were talking about the percent of taxes from each type of tax, and has the sales tax base dropped a lot? It's showing 31.2% of the state revenue. Have we seen that going down steadily because of the indicators that you just mentioned? Mr. Shepner?
Madam Chair, I don't have the number in front of me, but yes, there's been an erosion of the sales tax base as more consumption has moved towards the services sector. And that's a natural thing to happen as incomes grow. You become less and less dependent on spending a greater proportion of your money on food and turning towards services.
Senator Ortman?
Has that been counterbalanced because of the increases in rates over time? Because that's one of the things we've done is increased those rates from when it was initially instituted at 3% all the way up to almost 7%. And then you've got the local option sales taxes on top of that. So I'm wondering, has that erosion of the base been counterbalanced by increases in rates and local option sales taxes?
Mr. Shepherd.
Madam Chair, I would say that total receipts in terms of the sales tax as a proportion of total revenues has eroded or would have neutralized as a result of an increasing in the rate. But we're just talking solely about the base and what we tax. And so that over itself, as consumption has moved towards services, has actually eroded.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members, the next finding was the Minnesota statutory budget reserve ceiling has not grown to an appropriate level to adequately manage the underlying risks in Minnesota's tax system over time. This is kind of a just an FYI for future years. I know what the budget challenges we're facing right now, but basically we don't have a budget reserve. We don't have one in place. Even before, when we did have a budget reserve, our finding was that it wasn't at an appropriate level to manage the volatility within our system, which is evident now. Item 14, Minnesota needs a cash flow reserve account of sufficient size so that the state can avoid short-term external borrowing during the biennium. There's the issue of revenues and expenditures, but there's also the issue of cash flow. And the finding here was of just saying that we need enough cash flow in the system to avoid short-term borrowing from external sources. We know the state has had a practice of borrowing from internal funds rather than borrowing from external funds, and we think that that has to be taken into consideration as well. Okay, now we'll move on to the recommendations of the group. And a lot of the recommendations we've seen before. So this was a 2009 report. One of the recommendations was based out of a 1992 report. So some of these ideas have been around for a while, and I don't think they've gotten any less important over this period of time. So I'll just run through these, if you have, again, relatively quickly. Create a permanent long-range planning function in state government. Item two, release a demographic forecast at the start of each biennium, not just a budgetary forecast, but a demographic forecast as to where we see our demographic trends going. Item three is financial forecast should be based on current law and inflation or deflation of both revenues and expenditures to provide an accurate planning perspective. This was the one area where there was some contention. We did have a minority report from one of the members with regard to this. Having said that, we had very little discussion about this among our group. Art Rolnix, I recall his comment saying, you know what, I think inflation should be included in the planning forecast. But you know what? It's not that big a deal that we should spend so much time on it, because it's just helpful to know from planning perspective. But with regard to everything we're dealing with here within the Budget Trends Commission, it's not that big a deal as we're looking at all these other structural issues that we're being challenged with.
Mr. Goodnow, as I've been studying the budget, I notice that we have a lot of growth factors, and they're not necessarily inflation, I guess, but they kind of are. I mean, it's what the budget will be inflating to because of various issues that, you know, maybe just more enrollment in a program or more enrollment in our schools. There seems to be quite a few areas of the budget that have some very major growth factors in, which is obvious because otherwise we wouldn't be projecting a $38 billion budget that would be needed for the next biennium. So I'm just wondering the difference between those.
Madam Chair, and this was a difficulty in the discussion, is that there is some inflation built into our current forecasting system. With my background being the former commissioner of the Department of Human Services, that's the agency in the budget area that's the most guilty of that aspect. It's related to a number of factors. You mentioned enrollment growth in the programs, and of course, usually when the economy goes down, growth in Medicaid programs goes up. You also have the factor that the people coming on the programs have higher needs and have higher acuity levels, so they cost more. But there is also an inflationary factor, especially on the managed care programs, that's built into the system. And so there are elements within the state budget that do have inflation built into that spending, but there are certainly elements that do not. And so, how you manage this inflationary or deflationary factor within that system, you'd need to figure it out. And it's not very precise right now, but it is a planning forecast. And the commission itself felt that's information that would be valuable to the decision makers as you're making decisions on the budget.
Senator Bach.
Well, Madam Chair, we spend a lot of time in this committee, in this room, talking about interactions. I mean, decisions that we make here have interactions in other areas. For instance, the property tax increases that we've been seeing are having a significant impact on state spending.
I mean, as property taxes go up, more people are eligible for larger amounts of the property tax refund program. So that, commonly referred to as a circuit breaker, that goes up. As property taxes go up, more businesses have larger write-offs against their income when they file their tax returns. So their receipts to the state go down. So there is, based on decisions we make, it's not all outside of our control. Based on decisions we make here, there are interactions with both general fund spending and revenue that does or does not come into the state.
Madam Chair.
Perry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Goodnow, for some reason, I don't know why, but I took the initiative to read the core reports. And I find it very interesting that we have all these recommendations since 91, 92, 93. Now the latest one, the Commission on Service Innovation that was just released, which had recommendations that appeared to be just cut and paste from the core report. To your knowledge, have any of these recommendations been acted upon? And if so, which ones? Or are we just bringing past data forward in hopes that someday somebody's going to capture it and actually do something with it? I mean, I'm finding it hard to see what recommendations have actually, over the course of the years, been move forward with action.
Mr. Goodnow.
Madam Chair, Senator Perry, some recommendations have been acted upon. I know if you move back to the first recommendation, the permanent long-range planning function of the state government, there was, Governor Carlson did move forward with an initiative like that. That permanent function then went away. But so permanency around the legislative process goes in a couple of year cycles. But the demographic forecast, I believe the MMB is doing that at this point. So there are elements of it, of the report and recommendations that have been picked up. We did have some legislation that was introduced to enact some of these things in certain forms. Some of our recommendations, you know, quite frankly, I think the legislature at that point was distracted with a huge budget deficit and was wondering how could we, you know, we all have different priorities when each legislative session comes forward. So I guess I won't speak for any legislative session as to why they did or did not move forward with any recommendations.
Senator Michelle.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And for Mr. Goodnow, I'm curious about the second bullet on the recommendation page here about a demographic forecast. And this might go beyond the scope of today's hearing, Madam Chair, but I know Mr. Gillespie's in the room. I guess my question is there any demography in our current twice-a-year state budget forecasts? And so that's one question. And the second question is, what kind of demographic forecast are you talking about seeing, wanting to be seen at the start of each biennium? I mean, there's a lot there. There's a lot there. What are you trying to highlight? Thank you.
Madam Chair, Senator Michelle, I will take a stab at the question, and then I'll defer to others if they would like to. I think the intent of the commission when they put this recommendation down was that the demographic information that we discussed earlier on in our findings, the aging level, the dependency issue, there's issues related to the diversity, the lack of the impact on the education system on who's graduating, how many diplomas are out there, the workforce factors. All those things should be included in the system and should be looked at. I'll just revert back to my expertise in the human services side. I do know that when we're looking at forecasts in the Medicaid budget, mm-hmm. that we do look at the potential, you know, where do we see enrollment growing in the future based on the economy and other issues. And one of those other factors would be the demographics out there, where we see the trends going. We use the best information that's available in trying to project. They use the best information available when making those projections. The problem is that the information that's the best information available isn't always so reliable, and we really are, especially in the Medicaid budget where we have such high growth factors. You know, we could use a much better tool than we have right now to project that and forecast that and track it. But nobody really has a good tool. I've always said and I've always thought that Minnesota does a pretty good job as compared to other states in forecasting expenditures, but we don't do a very good job. But as compared to other states, we do a really good job, but overall, we don't really have a good system in place.
Mr. Rayton?
And you can disagree with me on that one.
Madam Chair, Senator, there was legislation actually to include demographics in the forecast and to have a long-range demographic forecast released. And so in the November forecast that was released just last November, we did have a demographic section.
And just to follow up on that, so
Senator Michelle,
is that enough? Is that does that kind of fulfill your second bullet there, or were you looking for more or more specific demographic information?
That's
right.
You won.
That inclusion was in response to the recommendation.
Okay. And Madam Chair,
congratulations,
Senator Michelle. It's a victory, but not, you know, now that those tools are out there, I think we can enhance the tools that we have.
Yeah.
Because I think the key is that we just want the recommendations are based on providing decision makers with as much useful information as possible and making decisions moving forward with regard to the state budget and making policy decisions. More recommendations. And these recommendations were based to achieve a long-term balance of state revenues and expenditures, minimize tax exemptions, deductions, and credits unless necessary for federal conformity. That's the whole issue is you have a stable system, the more exemptions and credits you put in, the more unstable the system becomes. To help the governor and legislature manage long-term obligations, the state should begin by spending no more in current biennial budget than can be supported by ongoing revenues. And the final one was any additional one-time revenue should be used strictly for building reserves, paying off shifts, capital projects, or other one-time purposes. This gets into a fairly lengthy discussion the commission had, and it was former Commissioner Kudrowski that really pushed this concept that we have our two-year budget cycle, and we try to project 4 years out. We have that volatility that we talked about earlier among that. If you look at a five-year rolling average, you have more stability than that. And we should really look at a baseline type of growth factor within your budget so you're not budgeting based on the volatility in the system, but you're budgeting based on a baseline. And to the extent that the revenues exceed the baseline, that should be considered one-time revenues, and that those revenues should be used for one-time purposes only, and we shouldn't be making permanent either tax reductions or spending decisions based on that volatility, those one-time impacts within the budget system. So there's Mud. All right.
Thanks to me.
To achieve a long-term balance of state revenues and expenditures, additional expenditure forecast should include information about rates of growth by expenditure area, like we had in the report. The governor and legislature should create a structurally balanced budget for the current and following biennium. Sorry, I'm going forward, right? Again, I guess that still holds true. When making budgetary decisions to achieve a balance of expenditures and revenues, the governor and legislature should consider the impact of shifting the expenditure burden to the private sector or local units of government. This is more of a cautionary statement there that as the system is interactive and everything works together, that as we make decisions at the state level, it does have impact at the local levels and in the private sector as well. So we need to keep that in mind.
Mr. Goodnow, I was going to ask you about the structurally balanced budget. And, you know, we always try and look at tails. And I know that I was meeting with some people from other states this fall, and it seems that we have one of the longest lookouts of any state in the country because we always ask for the projections for the next biennium. And a lot of states go year by year and some just by the current biennium, and a couple do three, and we were one of only a handful or maybe three of them that did a four-year outlook. But, you know, I guess I'm thinking back in 2007. I think we really had a four-year structurally balanced budget, and it all went to heck. I mean, I don't think anyone could have forecast what ended up happening. I mean, look where we're at today. And so I'm wondering if there really is a lot of accuracy in doing that, if there's a lot of time spent in going through that effort, and then it's for naught. I'm just wondering what your perspective is on that.
Madam Chair, I appreciate your your reflections on that. I do think, as I mentioned before, Minnesota does a very good job in looking forward and trying to project its budgets into the future biennium, as opposed to other states. It has helped us manage, I believe, in ways that other states don't. For example, in taking offers from the federal government of, hey, you know, this program will give you all kinds of money here, but, you know, when we look at with our budgeting and the way we're trained, is we look at, well, yeah, that's great. So this year, next year, it helps us. But what happens in the fourth year and fifth year? And are we taking a federal burden? So there's some interactions there that I think it is helpful because it changes our mindset to look beyond just the immediate biennium in balancing it. We do have only a constitutional amendment to balance the current biennium. And so I think the recommendation with the structurally balanced is that, you know, that's what you should strive for because we do have instability in the system. If you start out with the presumption that you're not going to have a structurally balanced system, and then you have an economic downturn and problems like we had, you're even going to be in worse shape then. So I think, you know, we were asked to try to reduce the volatility in the system and come up with recommendations to do that. One of those recommendations is with the tools we have, the best tools available, let's forecast what a structurally balanced budget looks like, and we should adopt those. We have some other recommendations that relate to, okay, so then what happens when those assumptions change? And even though we thought we had a structurally balanced forecast or budget, that we had some economic downturn, and now we're out of alignment. We do have recommendations around that as well.
Senator Ortman?
Commissioner, isn't there a flaw in that, though? If all we're doing is static scoring, the one-for-one, and we're not trying to predict changes in behavior that occur, especially in our revenue sources and the law changes that we adopt, and also those interactions that Senator Bach talked about, because if you make one decision at the state level, it impacts governments at other level and the private sector. And so I can see where it would be a good thing to try and project out the impact for an additional biennium, but if we're not really doing a good job of predicting some of those behavioral changes, I'm just not sure how valuable that information is.
Mr. Goodenough.
Madam Chair, Senator Ortman, I've been in conference committees where I've discussed with my counterpart that the value of those, the four-year projections. And the reality is, my experience and what I've understood is that the second biennium is a planning estimate. It doesn't have as solid of information around it as the immediate biennium that that you'd be working at. And as you know, there's really a lot of instability within the system, even with the first biennium that you're dealing with, that instability increases as you go out. I think part of looking out beyond and looking at structural balance is to look at, if you make a spending decision today, if it has a growth factor in it, for example, if you're expanding Medicaid and it takes you 12 months to get approval from the federal government, and then your program, it takes 12 months to ramp up before it's at full cost. For the current biennium, you'll show zero costs in the first year, half costs in the second year, and then you'll be ramping up into the third and fourth year. If you don't look at those third and fourth years, you can find yourself in some really difficult situations in that third and fourth year because of commitments you make in year one and two. So I do think it's valuable. It's not perfect, but it's valuable.
Mr. Shepner.
Madam Chair, Senator, I would also add that when we, well, making economic forecasts is a difficult job. It's difficult to know what's going to happen not only this upcoming year, but it's sometimes difficult to know what has already even happened in terms of data reliability and et cetera. So when we do the current biennium forecast, it does incorporate more business cycle components, but by the time we do get out to those planning estimates, which I would also repeat, those are planning estimates, we're more or less back to a trend. And so in terms of looking at this structurally, it's by the time you get out to those planning estimates, you're more or less back to a longer-term trend in the economy.
Okay. Thank you.
Moving right along. Two more recommendations here. Create a long-term public-private group with responsibility to annually recommend policy changes for controlling the total cost of public health care and medical assistance services. Okay, that's a recommendation we included. And finally, address education attainment gaps in the current K-12 education system. Recommendations to manage state budget volatility. If forecast revenues exceed trendline growth, and I mentioned that earlier, trend line revenue growth rates should be the basis for spending decisions. So in other words, if you see a trend line, if you see expenditure revenues exceeding a trend line growth factor, they should be treated as one-time revenues and not as ongoing revenues that are available for permanent spending decisions or revenue reductions. Point two, permanent tax reductions or expenditure increase should only be undertaken under certain circumstances, which is what we just kind of mentioned there. And three, Minnesota management and budget should determine the size of the budget reserve necessary given the volatility of the state revenues. We had made a recommendation that the budget reserve be based off of a, I believe it was a two-biennia decrease, or basically a one in 20 years, so basically, let's see, how do I say this?
95% chance.
Madam Chair, 95% likelihood that there won't be a debt. So we'd be planning for the 5% event. So every one in every 20 years, you're going to have a deficit. We should plan for a budget reserve that would manage that deficit in that for that happening that happens one in every 20 years based on the trend line.
That's great.
It's coming back to me. Given the, and this goes on to that, given the current size of the state budget and the current level of revenue volatility, the budget reserve should be increased to $2.1 billion. This is 2 years ago now. I'm assuming this may have changed a bit. The currently calculated level to provide adequate cushion against economic changes in two consecutive biennia. If the budget reserve is depleted in the current biennium, it should be replenished within two biennia. That gives you a chance. You know, the whole issue of having a rainy day fund, but you don't never want to spend it because it's you never know if it's really raining enough. We want people to be able to, and decision makers be able to use that revenue, that budget reserve for the rainy day, but make sure it gets replenished in a pretty quickly. Finally, a cash flow account should be maintained separate from the budget reserve to avoid short-term external borrowing. That's a separate issue, and that deals strictly with cash flow. And that should be based on the cash flow account necessary to keep the state from doing short-term borrowing. So that there shouldn't be a set amount saying it needs to be $1 billion or $1.5 billion. It needs to be based on all the resources the state has available to it at any one time and over the period of time so that to avoid external short-term borrowing.
Madam Chair.
Senator Howe.
Madam Chair, Commissioner Goodenow, could you explain to me, you know, you said you're planning for a 1 in 20-year event, but how did you come to that $2.1 billion? Because is there a percentage factor on that? Because if you're talking general fund, you're looking at 6%. If you're talking total revenue, you're looking at 3.5%. I'm just wondering what – how you – came to that percentage
Madam
or
Chair,
that dollar.
I'm going to need some help from somebody at the table on that.
Ms. Rachin?
It's based on a percentage of total revenues to the state, and I believe it's it was a range that was given in the report of 2.2 to 3.9% of total revenues over a two biennia period.
Okay, and I'm just wondering from your recommendation here, Madam Chair, if we shouldn't have a percentage rather than a dollar amount because things are going to be changing all the time.
Madam Chair, Senator Howe, yes. That was also a point of contention within the commission. We agreed on a dollar amount because it was easier to explain than a formula, but some of us felt the formula would be better.
Ms. Rayton.
Madam Chair, Senator, also, it's driven by the level of volatility, the calculation, and so if volatility changes over time, that percentage would change over time as well.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
The intent was to let the experts on the economists try to determine the formula that would make it work and would be the appropriate level of reserve based on all those various factors out there.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator, excuse me, Mr. Goodenow. You said that, or one of you said the difference between, or the suggested reserve would be 2.1 to 3.1% of projected revenue. To get a little better idea of the message we send to our local units of government, counties, for instance, and their reserves and cities via the state recommendations to them, is that comparatively the same? Or are counties more? Just to get a...
Ms. Raiden.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry, I don't have that information.
Madam Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, based on, I better not say. I believe it's that local units of government usually have higher reserves than the state does. Based on my
experience.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Excuse me, that's percentage-wise higher than.
Madam Chair, that's my recollection.
Thank you.
There's a lot of qualifications in that recollection, by the way.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, I remember looking at reports from the state auditor several years ago where some of the counties had at least 50% reserves. I don't know that that is the case anymore, but for a time they did have very healthy reserve funds. And I don't know what their auditors were recommending to them, but I'm sure it was higher than 2 or 3%.
Madam Chair.
Senator Howe.
Madam Chair, I believe the League of Minnesotans makes a recommendation to the local units of government, and I believe it's 50% is what they recommend to have in reserves.
50%?
Madam Chair.
Senator Ortman.
I've recently looked at the auditor's recommendation, which is 25 to 50%.
Is that what it is? Thank you.
50% would be on the high end.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Goodenough, when is the last time the state had a reserve level that's recommended of the 2.1?
Ms. Rayton.
And is that that's obviously off a formula. Do the other states use a similar formula, or how is that based off of? Perhaps you already. I got a call from my college son, so I.
Ms. Rayton.
Madam Chair, Senator, I'm not aware that we've ever had a reserve at that level. Our statutory reserve is set at $653 million. So the statutory language that takes surplus in the forecast and puts it into the reserve automatically fills that reserve up to $653 million currently. And in terms of other states, I'm not aware of what their reserve levels are, but given the fiscal situation of other states currently, I'm assuming most states have spent down their reserves at this point. And the formula is based on work that was done by our economists at MMB based on the volatility of our revenue system.
Thank you.
I'm just looking at this and seeing the recommendation of $2.1 billion. And quite frankly, we borrowed from our school districts last year $1.8 billion to help with our budget deficit. And I'm wondering, when we were talking about a 20-year cycle, having this be in place for a 20-year cycle, what are we in now that it's so much greater than what you would have projected for a 20-year cycle? It is a historic time, I'm sure, but how often would we see these kinds of declines in revenues happening?
Madam Chair, the recommendation was based off of it being the 5%, you know, 1 in 20 period. Now, we've gone through a string of periods here where, you know, we've had a number of those in a row. It's kind of like preparing for the 100-year flood, and it happens every other year. We've had a string of those, but on average, on the trend, this recommendation is based on a trend line and information we have, and I'm getting way beyond my depth now.
Madam Chair, it also assumes that the budget is structurally balanced at the beginning of the biennium. So if arguably the current situation we're in now, the budget was not structurally balanced in terms of the definition that MMB provides moving into 10 and 11. And then back to the point, this recession is the 100-year flood that doesn't come along very often. So I think even in the report 2 years ago, we knew that this was that 1 in 20 shot that we're eating up right now. I'd also like to get back to the $2.1 billion is to cover two bienniums worth of economic activity. Currently, the $653 million we use in terms of budgeting is statutorily for one biennium in terms of how we structure to raise that to an appropriate level. 2 years ago, there was some legislation passed that was a result of this that asked that we provide a letter to the legislature. I believe the Finance Committee of Senate and the House Ways and Means Committee, each year, each January 15th, that updates this number. And in that number, we actually provide a percentage of the current up or approaching biennium. So we do a one biennium number. And then we also do a percentage and we do a dollar level. So we actually provide both in that annual letter now. Prior to us doing this, there hadn't been much research on what an appropriate budget reserve was, even nationally. I think our Council of Economic Advisors had put down kind of a stake at about 5%, but really there was no economic or research basis behind that. So this actually does put some numbers to it.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Goodnow, is the commission still going, or are you out of a job, or are you done with no more studies?
Madam Chair, Senator Mr. Rosen, unfortunately it ended in January 2009. It was a very valuable experience, but very time-consuming. Madam Chair, we do have one last recommendation. I might as well throw that up, and that's just to say that the whole issue of the ability of the state to borrow against internal funds to manage the cash flow should also be looked at and maximized as much as possible to avoid outside borrowing. That's the last recommendation.
Thank you. Do members have any questions? Senator Howell.
Madam Chair, Commissioner Goodnow, did the commission look at like going to a zero-based budgeting? And I'm just wondering if we were to eliminate all exemptions and every biennium, every 2 years, had people make the case of why something should be exempt, if that would control the volatility in the budget somewhat. And I'm just wondering if there was any consideration given to that sort of mind frame or idea.
Mr. Goodnow?
Madam Chair, Senator Howe, no, I don't recall any discussions around zero-based budgeting within the commission. The challenge, again, this is coming from the human services side, the challenge with doing that on the Medicaid side is that our Medicaid programs are based on a combination of federal requirements and federal authority. In order to arguably go to a zero-based budgeting, you'd have to have them agree to that way. I mean, there's a process where even when we make changes to the program, we have to go and get their authority and their approval in some areas to make those structural changes. So I understand and appreciate the concept. I'm just not sure practically how it works in some parts of state budgeting. Other parts it may work fine, but we did not get into that discussion.
Madam Chair, what about the concept of eliminating all exemptions and having the case made every biennium for those exemptions? Would that, I mean, just if you didn't consider it, do you think that would help control some of the volatility in the revenues?
Madam Chair, Senator Howell, this is not an issue that was discussed by the commission. I would say that you need to keep an eye on or understand what organizations, what entities are relying on those revenue streams, and if they're making long-term or short-term plans based on revenues available to them with regard to programming or other activities that they will be doing. We did in the report talk about minimizing tax exemptions, deductions, and credits. That's on the revenue side, but I'm not sure if you were focusing on the spending side as well. But I mean, it's people make plans for future plans based on what they know of the system and where they expect the system to be. And so you need to think about how that may impact that planning and the stability for some of those programs. And I'm not arguing against it. I'm just saying that's a consideration that I think needs to be made.
All right. Thank you.
Well, we have one more report to do yet today. So thank you, Mr. Goodnow, for bringing this information to us and to your assistants. We appreciate the information. It's useful. I wish we could be putting money away in a cash reserve right now. It's going to be a while, perhaps, before we can accomplish that goal.
And Madam Chair, members, really appreciate the opportunity to present these findings again. I think they're very meaningful, and I think there's some good information here. The one thing that we did tell people when we were presenting this back in 2009 is you don't need to come up with a $2 billion budget reserve today, but you can put the structures in place that require that or allow for that in the future. So there's a lot of structural things that you can do moving forward that will put you in a better position once we get through this downturn in the economy. So, again, thank you very much for your time. Appreciate you.
Thank you. As we're switching over, we had the discussion on tax expenditures last time, and I'm wondering if anyone has read through the book and had some areas that jumped out at them as unusual, perhaps, or curious as to why they were put in place. Did anyone have any comments about that? On the tax expenditures? There were many of them to review, hundreds, perhaps. Senator Ortman?
Madam Chair, I would just say there are many anomalies in that tax expenditure report, and I'll just point out one for everyone's edification. Garden planting versus landscaping. Any prediction as to whether which or both are subject to sales tax? That's kind of a trick question, but garden planting is taxable, landscaping is not. So we have more landscapers than garden planters in the state of Minnesota. Just thought you'd all want to know.
Well, thank you. And welcome. We're going to have a report on the comparative state tax and spending rankings. And we have with us Mark Haveman and Aaron Twait. Is that right? And if you would introduce yourselves, perhaps we'll get the pronunciations accurate.
Madam Chair, members, thank you. I'm Mark Haveman, Executive Director of the Minnesota Taxpayers Association, and my research director, Aaron Twait, is with us today as well. For those of you who are not familiar with the MTA, we are an 85-year-old research and education organization in support of efficient government and good tax policy. We have been very active for many, many years in this issue of comparative rankings of state tax and spending systems. I'll be sharing with you three report findings today. The first is something we've been doing for over 40 years now, where we basically assemble and analyze census data from governments pertaining to taxes and expenditures. That is called How Does Minnesota Compare? It comes out annually. And then we do two specialty studies that look specifically at tax burdens being imposed. The first one is on property taxes, and the second one is on individual income taxes. For starters, how does Minnesota compare? Again, this information comes from the Census Bureau. What we do, and this is important, we combine state and local data in our analysis for a very important reason. States differ dramatically in how they allocate responsibilities for service delivery between state and local units of government and how they design their revenue systems accordingly. So we take a holistic perspective to try to make sure that we aren't making apples to oranges comparisons when we do these ranking efforts. We look at these rankings through two lenses. The first is a per capita basis, which is best sort of described as sort of a burden imposed perspective. This is the absolute amounts spent and collected per person. The second lens is the per $1,000 of income basis, which can be sort of considered a claim on resources, and in a very broad sense, a sort of a ability to pay perspective on this. Both are relevant. Both are meaningful. Neither one is superior to the other. It's worth keeping both in mind when you look at these rankings. We'll start with state and local tax collections, and just jumping to the bottom, you see that Minnesota is sort of Lake Wobegon in some ways, slightly above average with respect to total taxes. We are below the national average in sales and property taxes, and sales taxes is a function of two things. One, we have a slightly more constrained sales tax base than other states, but more significantly, this reflects that Minnesota is far less generous in providing a local option sales tax authority to the units of government than a lot of other states do. To provide some historical perspective on this, this looks at the rankings from about 10 years ago. And again, there's a two-year lag time on this. That's why the most recent information is fiscal year 2008. And notably, only the excise tax collections have grown relative to the national averages. Interestingly, ranking declines have been the sharpest for both property and sales taxes, as you can see there. And overall tax burden is out of the top 10 on either metric.
I'm Chair.
Senator Magnus.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Haveman, I know these are 2008 numbers. If you look at the sales tax, if you include the legacy amendment, what ranking would that be?
Mr. Haveman?
If you could give us an update. If we included those numbers, instead of being 27th, say, per capita, what would be, how much would that raise us with that 0.375% increase?
Mr. Haveman?
Madam Chair, Senator, I don't know where that would put us in the ranking. Certainly that would have a, obviously bump us up by about $300 million, I would say. But then again, the challenge with these things is you don't know exactly what other states are doing at the same time.
Yeah.
And where we would fall into that ranking is largely a function of what modifications other states may be doing to their tax base as well.
Okay. Thank you.
Of course, taxes are just one piece of the overall revenue system, and here you have both a historical perspective all revenues, all general revenues provided to state and local government. You can see there that the revenue for three sources have all declined relative to national averages. And notably, and this has been pointed out many times before, that Minnesota does rely much heavily on federal revenues than other states. But you can see the just the significance of per capita per $1,000 income here. Very, you know, Minnesota is a high income state. And as a result, the discrepancies between per capita measures and per income measures are likely to be quite large. And you'll see that again and again as you go through this report. Another way to think about this, is, of course, is the income remaining after state and local taxes. And Minnesota, although it had the 12th highest in 1998, income remaining after taxes as a percentage of the income, it was one of the lowest. And since that time, we've sort of bucked the national trend.
Senator Est?
Mr. Haveman, what's the definition of income that you use? Is it for individuals? Is it gross income, AGI? What do you use? Taxable income?
What is the income? Madam Chair, Senator Rest, we use the personal income that's provided by the BEA and I can get a fuller definition of that to you.
In general, what
Senator Rest,
what for those, you know, just kind of a lay understanding of what per capita income relates to, is it you know, wages and interest, and I mean
Madam
all of that
Chairs.
Income that would be reported on an income tax return? Is it non-taxable income as well, like Social Security? Is it a comprehensive definition of income? Just curious.
Mr. Toy?
Madam Chair, Senator Rest, it would be taxable income. It would also be, I think, Social Security income. But what it generally would not include would be non-taxable types of income, transfer payments, for instance.
Well, Social Security is not taxable for many people, Madam Chair. I'd be interested if you could just
get that to you.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Hoppeman.
Switching to the other side of the ledger on state and local tax expenditures. This is in all the categories. It represents about 85%, I believe, of total expenditures. Size of the slide prevented us from doing some of the smaller ones. But you can see there in 2008, we spent, again, slightly above the national average with respect to all expenditures. Public welfare, which is a little bit of a misnomer because it's far beyond what people think of welfare in terms of income support. That includes a variety of health and human service programs targeting at-need populations, seniors, things of that nature. Public welfare and highways being the only two areas that we are currently in the top 10 on a per capita basis. Moving on, to provide some perspective on how that has changed over time, we present the same information from 1998. I guess the two things to flag here are, first of all, that our total expenditures as a percent of The national averages have declined since 2008. We were at about 17% of the national average on a per capita basis, and about 10% on a per $1,000 income basis. And the other thing to note as well is the flip-flop there of at the very top of K-12 education, public welfare. In 10 years, public welfare spending has assumed the top ranking. And I think this provides some additional color and perspective on what was discussed in the previous presentation. This 44% per capita expenditure over the national average for public welfare that we have essentially maintained over the course of the last 10 years is a very powerful crowding out issue. For local governments. That 44% represents about $6 billion in spending. Now, of course, that's not all state money, but I think it does provide some perspective, as discussed earlier, about what kind of influence those programs have for the state on an ongoing basis.
Senator Pogomiller?
Quick question. Are the two charts comparable? Because the second chart has general expenditures and the first chart just doesn't label it that way. Are they apples to apples?
Mr. Haberman?
Yes.
Thank you.
And some of the, Madam Chair, Senator Pogomiller, some of the categories may have changed because, again, we took the top 15 or 11 of them or something of that nature, and since that time some of them moved up into a higher.
Senator Pogomiller?
But you can compare
yes.
the two charts?
Yes, you can.
Pretty accurately?
Yes.
Thank you.
Mr. Haberman?
Just, again, to give a little more perspective on the evolution of the spending side, you can see here that back in 1998, there were about 11 categories where Minnesota spent more than the national average. That represents about 73% of state and local spending. Things have changed in the last 10 years or so. Now only five areas do we spend above the national average, representing about 45% of state and local spending. K-12 is close. So if you, I believe it's on a per capita basis, 99 point something percent, a little less on a per $1,000 income basis. But if you add that into the other side of the equation, then, of course, that jumps it up to 67%.
Senator Ortman.
Can you distinguish for me the two categories of public welfare and health and hospitals? How do you distinguish those?
Mr. Haberman.
Madam Chair, Senator, I believe the public welfare programs are more income assistance related types of programs, and the human service types programs, and the health and hospitals are more health care delivery.
Thank you.
Senator Ingebertson.
Thank you. Could you off of Senator Pogomiller's question, help me clarify the back up one page there. Can you tell me in the 1998 judicial legal that is not on here, why that's not on here, and is it, I didn't quite understand why you said they wouldn't be on there.
Madam Chair, Senator Ingebritsen, it was to make the slide visible, we just took the top 11 categories or so. So that category fell out or moved up depending on what year we were looking at. It's still there. We just to make it legible, we didn't fit it on.
Senator Berglund.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm just still trying to kind of follow up on the question that Senator Ortman asked about the difference between public welfare and health and hospitals. So I imagine one of the things that would be in public welfare would be things like our MFIP program, which is less than 2% of our total budget. So I'm wondering if this category of public welfare is a very, it may not be a very large total expenditure, and just a small amount of spending might put you considerably over the national average. And I'm wondering if that's true in this case.
Mr. Haberman.
Madam Chair, Senator, I would suggest that we get the actual census definitions and send them around so people can have a good understanding of what each element goes into each of these, into each program areas. We don't have that information, I don't believe, at our fingertips here.
Well, Senator Madam Chair, I'd appreciate that because I think otherwise this could be quite misleading in terms of where there might be a lot of extra spending and it might not be a lot after all.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think any further explanation you have of these categories would be helpful, but a plain reading of this chart suggests that per person we spend $1,915.04 annually towards public welfare programs that would include MFIP, but other programs like that. And that's at the top of our chart. It is the highest amount of our spending for state and local expenditures, and health and hospitals, that healthcare delivery system falls somewhere down below there. But I don't think you can misread this chart and say we're not spending that money on public welfare programs, even if one or two of them might be very small. Cumulatively, they are $1,900. Am I reading that right?
Mr. Havala? Yes, he's indicating yes.
It's like where does nursing homes go?
Right, but Madam Chair.
Senator Berglund.
So are nursing homes public welfare, or are nursing homes considered health and hospitals?
Mr. Habermann?
That's what matters.
I will check this, but I'm pretty sure they'll be found in public welfare, Madam Chair.
Right.
So, you know, and it might be then that the reason that it's grown is because we have more elderly. And I just think we need more information to understand this chart better.
Senator Berglund, I agree. Senator, we need more information.
Mr. Habermann.
Madam Chair, I think I will turn over to Aaron for a review of the 50-state property tax.
Senator Pogamiller.
So aside from details, the big picture is we've gone from 5th per capita to 15th per capita and 17th per 1,000 income to 31st. Can I read this right?
Madam Chair, Senator Pogamiller, yes.
And when is
Senator Pogamiller?
When is the? Do you have? When are you going to have 09 and 10?
Mr. Habermann.
Madam Chair, Senator, I believe that's a September October release.
Do you do it annually or every 2 years?
Every year.
So in October, Senator you'll Pogamiller? Have 09. Yes.
Madam Chair, Senator Pogamiller, yes.
Thank you very much.
Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair, would that then reflect the fact that the spending continued but incomes dropped in 2009 and 2010?
Mr. Havaman.
Madam Chair, Senator, if I understood the question correctly, we won't know until those numbers come
look
out.
Look at K-12 education.
The one thing, Madam Chair, Senator, that is probably worth noting is that there is likely to be some shuffling as a result of capturing what has gone on in the Great Recession. In some interesting ways. We do know, for example, that 8 states in the country either increased the marginal tax rate on their top income earners or created another bracket. At the same time, about the same number of states did the opposite, decreased the top marginal rate or made some changes as a result. So you've got some shuffling obviously going on. That's just on the revenue side, and probably some extraordinary things happening on the expenditure side. So the next 2 or 3 years as this data comes out is going to be quite interesting.
Thank you.
We better continue.
Madam Chair, Senators, again for the record, my name is Aaron Twait. I'm the Research Director for the MTA. I'm going to talk briefly about our property tax comparison study. We do this every year. The first study was undertaken in April 1995. At that point, we did not do it every year. We started doing it every year in April 2004. The study sort of supplements the census data that's in here, that the property tax collections. We look at burdens on a class-by-class basis. For 4 classes of property: residential homesteads, commercial, think retail, industrial, think manufacturing, and apartments. We look at 3 sets of locations. One set is what we call our urban analysis. That is the largest city in each state. It also includes Washington, D.C., and it also includes the second largest cities in Illinois and New York, because Chicago and the city of New York have very different property tax systems than the remainder of the state. And so in some ways, it's useful to think of it as a comparison of 53 different property tax systems. We also look at the 50 largest cities in each state, and we also look at a rural set of cities, one from each state as well. For purposes of time, I'll sort of, if people have questions about specific questions about the methodology, feel free to contact us and we will get back to you on it. I do want to note that there are a couple of limitations in the study, and they generally deal with how property tax relief is treated. The study does not account for policies that freeze or cap increases in home value or residential taxes based on the length of tenure, so that's sort of a limited market value type thing. We also don't consider income-sensitive tax relief programs, and that's just a function of how we put the study together, and that we don't track necessarily individual parcels from 1 year to the next. We hold the value of the parcels in the studies constant from 1 year to the next. We're presenting results from 3 years, from payable 1995, which was the first year we did the study. Our most recent study is for payable 2009. Our paid 2010 study should come out sometime in April. And then the midpoint between those two, which was our paid 2002 study. As you can see, in 1995, for our sort of lower income parcel, we had a sort of modest tax compared to the national average. Rank was 24th. For the $150,000 value parcels, we were in the mid-teens. You see drops in pay 2002. That was largely the result of the property tax reforms from the year before. For payable 2009, our ranks have climbed somewhat, but they're not generally back up to that level that you saw in payable 1995. And they are generally at or below the national average for what we see in the study.
Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you have information about how they've changed over that time period within Minnesota, or you just are doing comparative with other states?
We are Mr. just Toyet? Doing comparative, but I would be happy to provide that information to you.
Senator Chamberlain.
Maybe I missed something. Why is the data not available for Minneapolis in 2002 or 95 for that $300,000 range?
Madam Chair, Senator Chamberlain, for 1995 and in 2002, we didn't do a $300,000 valued home example, and trying to go back and recreate some of that would be difficult at this point. The results for our commercial, in 1995, our commercial property generally ranked second, with one exception for the $100,000 valued property in Minneapolis. Again, you see in pay 2002 a fall in those, again, due to the property tax reforms. And they the ranks have held pretty steady for commercial property since then. One thing that you'll note is that the ranks and also the tax as a share of the study average do climb as value climbs, and that is generally due to Minnesota's two-tier classification, where we tax the first $150,000 at one level and the remainder at another. Results for our manufacturing properties, you see the same patterns, and so I won't go into that in a lot of detail. What I will say is that industrial property in Minnesota compares more favorably to the tax burden on it compares more favorably to the tax burden in other states, and that is because Minnesota exempts personal property from the property tax. Industrial property will tend to have a larger proportion of the total parcel value in personal property, and so even though you essentially have the same tax on that property, it compares more favorably to other states.
Senator Rust.
Madam Chair, sir, in the results for commercial retail and manufacturing, is it the case that in other states the rate that's applied is bifurcated, that there's a different rate for commercial and a different rate for manufacturing, even given that Minnesota, other than arguably utility property, is treated differently? Is that accommodated for in these rankings, that we treat commercial and manufacturing property the same, even given that we do not tax personal property, although we've tried to bifurcate that rate on occasion in the last 20 years, but we never have done that. But is that accounted for here in terms of apples to apples and oranges to oranges?
Madam Chair, Senator Rust, it is. We find that when the tax rates are bifurcated, that the differential is usually between sort of residential properties and commercial industrial. And commercial industrial usually have the same rate. There's a few states where there is some difference in that. But a lot of states treat those the same as we do. What we find is that the biggest difference in a lot of states between the way they treat commercial property and the way they treat manufacturing property has to do with the taxation of inventories.
Of what?
Of inventories.
Ah, yeah.
On the personal property side. And what we've seen over the last maybe 6 or 7 years has been a real move in a lot of states to exempt, especially inventories, but also in a couple of cases, to exempt machinery and equipment.
Well, we only have a few minutes left, so we'll have to move along.
I'll just sort of end this part by noting that, again, with the apartments, rural Minnesota in our PAY95 study was ranked number one. Minneapolis was ranked number two. Now they are at or below the national averages.
Finally, Madam Chair, our income
Mr.
tax.
Haberman. Mr. Haberman.
Our income tax comparison study. Again, this one looks at actual tax burdens, or models actual tax burdens. Once upon a time, we took some poor intern and put them in front of TurboTax for 3 months. Unfortunately, technology has improved, and we can use a simulation model created by the National Bureau of Economic Research to do this. But, of course, it's also only done for 41 states now because several states do not have personal income taxes. We work with the Department of Revenue, the research division, to help us develop profiles for various types of filers, which provides a breakdown of their income as well as some of their itemized deductions. And, of course, all that information has to be turned into sort of a state-specific measure as well for accurate comparisons with other states. So then we adjust those numbers based on statistics of income data from the IRS. To again, to attempt to create an apples-to-apples comparison across the states. Very quickly, some of the findings for married filing jointly. You see income tax relative to the national average. At about the national average, $50,000 level, of course, reflecting Minnesota's progressive income tax system moving up to about $22.7 million above the national average. $4 million filers. Of course, the net tax being less than zero at the $10,000 and $20,000 level is a function of the refundable credits program, the working family credit. The married filing joint assumes two children in the analysis. Singles, pretty much the same story. Slightly above the national average, then progressing slightly higher compared to the national average as the income levels increase. Head of household, pretty much the same story over time. Married filing jointly, this one at I think demonstrates a couple of things. First of all, that, of course, the percentage numbers there reflect the fact that we tax pension income in the state, and there are several states that don't. And I believe there are some states also that modify the taxation of Social Security income as well. The caution I have in making too much of that number is that, of course, this is a percentage number, and the base that we're talking about here is oftentimes rather low. It might be the difference, like a 100% increase would be the difference between $700 and $1,400. Not to suggest it's not real money for seniors, but when you have a relatively low base on which that these percentages are calculated, it may look a little more dramatic than it is. But as the rankings show, we are one of the higher taxing states of senior income in the nation. Our final slide looks at the progressivity. We're able to calculate and rank states based on their income tax progressivity by comparing the effective tax rates across different incomes. We use the $35,000 income as the basis because that's about the place where these distorting effects of working family credits and income support programs are. And as you can see there, when you compare that, Minnesota is about the sixth most progressive income tax system in the nation.
Okay. Well, we are out of time. I don't know if anyone has any questions. Maybe they could speak with our presenters afterwards. We just have a quick announcement. Next Tuesday, the Senate Finance Committee will be meeting at 8:30, and I think Senator Ortman has an announcement as well.
Members, the Senate Tax Committee will not meet on Tuesday morning, but we will take up military bills on Wednesday. Senator Wieger's bill and Senator Daley's bill will be heard on Wednesday. We haven't yet set an agenda for Thursday, so no meeting Tuesday, but we will hear bills on Wednesday.
And thank you very much to our presenters.
Take care.
From the Minnesota Taxpayer Association, and the meeting is adjourned.